Before I start, I want to mention something, too. I came across a very interesting Rashi, and no doubt the source is from the Oral Law, that I thought I'd bring to your attention, and we probably will come back to it later, but I think it's an interesting one. It's in Kings 2, 19:37. The last verse in chapter 19, Kings 2. And there it's discussing about the death of Sanherib. And it says that he was bowing down in the house of Nisroch, his god. Now, Rashi says, what kind of a word is that, the word Nisroch? And Rashi says that it comes from the word in Hebrew, Neser, which means a board. And Rashi explains that it was a board from the Ark of Noah that Sanherib had, that he kept in this house, and he worshipped it.
All right, Rabbi, what was the reference?
What the site?
2 Kings. All right, we got it.
Oh,
okay.
Got it. 2 Kings 19:37.
Okay, we got it. Thank you.
So Rashi explains, and another commentary also says the same thing, that the word for the name of his God comes from the Neser, which means a beam or a piece of wood, a slat or something, which came from the ark, from Noah's ark that he had found, and this was what he worshipped. He worshipped this piece of wood from Noah's Ark. And I was going through this, and I started to think, like, what does that mean, that he worshipped a piece of wood from Noah's Ark? And then I remembered it was a CBS special a few months ago where they had all about the Ark, Noah's Ark. And they had the various anecdotes and cases that happened relating to the ark. And one of them was this fellow who claimed he actually was in the ark and he had a piece of wood from the ark. And I remember that he said that this piece of wood has very special meaning to him. It's something that, you know, that he thinks will give him good luck, and he watches it and guards it very carefully. If I'm not correct, I believe that's what that's the way he portrayed it. And then I realize what it is, and I think it's an extremely important concept. And this is really the essence of Torah monotheism, and that is the reason why these people worship these things is because they believe that if they have a piece of wood from the ark that God actually used to save Noah, then this wood has got to have some kind, be endowed with some kind of special quality. And just being near that piece of wood, having it in your possession, is going to protect you and save you. And that was Sanherib's idea. And I see that about 2,500 years later, modern man really hasn't gone too far away from Sanherib's concept. The way this individual expressed how important that piece of wood is to him, like something from God, something special from God. That's the same kind of idolatrous concept, where the object becomes endowed with some kind of power or force. And the early Christian church, that was one of the things that I was reading recently, that one of the things that they took from the pagans was the idea of relics and attachment to objects as having some kind of power or force. Whereas the entire Torah is completely, vehemently opposed to such an idea, because it is God that saved Noah, and the piece of wood that he used doesn't make any difference what it was. And having and owning such a piece of wood does not bring a person any closer to God, and does not will not enhance his life, it won't make him live longer, it won't protect him from any kind of untoward event or illness or whatever. And that's Torah monotheism, and I just found it very interesting. Now, when you take a look at what happened in Kings 20, 19:37, and you think about what's happening now, 2,500 years later, and people think the words of the Torah are not valid because today, because it's unimportant, we don't have any more idolatry. I think they ought to take a look a little deeper into the concept, and they'll see how pertinent the idea is today and how modern man is still riddled with idolatrous concepts. And they're still there, and they're not too far away from Sennacherib. And this is something which I think we all share together. And those few people that are able to extricate themselves from idolatry in this world, namely the B'nai Noach and B'nai Israel, they really are unusual, because it is an extremely difficult thing, as you can see. When the Torah makes this its central thesis, the main concept in the Torah is abolition of idolatry, as the rabbis and scholars of the oral law say, the entire Torah is the abolition of idolatry. And we see how difficult that is to really carry it through. Man just wants to believe in these little powers that will save them. And they don't wish to accept God in abstract, that he is the only force, and that what occurs to us is based upon how we live our life, not upon any kind of relics or objects that we surround ourselves with. Even today, man isn't totally free. I just wanted to mention that, and we will come back to that in what I'm going to discuss tonight also. All right. Let me mention again, in case there are any questions on any points, don't hesitate to interrupt. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes?
It's interesting that you use the story from the Ark deal. The guy that had that plank's name was Jermiel, and he was a Muslim. He lives in Los Angeles, California.
Oh, really?
And it's been revealed, this is the story that I told you the other morning, that he, in collaboration with Professor LaRue, Dr. LaRue, at Southern UCLA, or Southern California, not UCLA, that they were angry at CBS for LaRue, a story that they had done on him. And so LaRue and Jermiel set up CBS, and that there was really, that plank was a from a pine tree in Northern California. And that Jermiel said that LaRue would validate his find. And he did, and then two or three other doctors, PhDs, said, yes, this is authentic. So that's the scholarly skullduggery we were talking about. Mm-hmm. That now the 40 million people watch that show,
right. And
if 10% of them believe that, then there's 4 million people know that there's a piece of Noah's Ark floating around somewhere today.
Wow, that's very interesting.
And that's how these myths continue, as you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's all I had to say.
Really, really, very interesting. The topic that we're going to discuss tonight is one which David asked me to do a while back, and that is the concept in the Torah of the clean animals and the unclean animals. And the reason for keeping kosher. What is the purpose of keeping kosher? What's the concept of kosher? And why did God differentiate between the clean animals and the unclean animals? Okay. Now, I'll start with a question that I think is extremely important. And I really would like, if you can, to try to give me an answer. Some of you from the audience. The question is a very basic one. It's one which I think everyone either thinks about or sometimes almost thinks about. When I say almost thinks about, I mean sometimes you allow a thought to come into your mind, but then you immediately dismiss it. But the question, I think, is something which everyone has in one way or another encountered. And it's a simple, basic one, which I think if a person doesn't have a clear answer for this question, their religious practice is seriously compromised, because they don't understand why they're doing things on a basic level, at least. Now, the question I'm referring to is, why do we keep God's commandments? whether it's B'nai Israel, whether it's B'nai Noach, makes no difference insofar as this question is concerned. The question is, why does man wish to keep God's law? Now, you know very well how Moses in Deuteronomy, where he gives the people, Moses in Deuteronomy appears as a different individual. He appears as a prophet, so to speak, where he gives the people Musar in Hebrew. Musar means exhortations, ethical exhortations, and religious exhortations. And the main thing that he keeps on repeating again and again is that you must keep God's laws, God's commandments. This must be kept. And over here, the difference between Deuteronomy and the rest of the Torah is that in Deuteronomy, Moses is the initiator of the statements himself. These are his own statements. God later told him to take those statements and make that the fifth book of the Bible, but he was the initiator of the statement on his own first. Whereas in the other part, it always says what Moses is saying. It means that Moses just used the exact God. A God statement was. God was the initiator. And that's why the style of the is a separate entity, by the way. For instance, there's a question in the Talmud, what kind of a Sefer Torah, what kind of a scroll king must have? King has a separate scroll that's with him always, as you know. Some want to say that he only had to have the last of his five books. Deuteronomy. That was the only book that he had to have. It's an argument among the Tanaim. And the reason is because the purpose for the why the king to have the scroll of the times is because it should be ethically perfect.
Shut him down and call him back.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Let us stop this and call you back.
So Moses in Deuteronomy, you know, it's interesting, but David and I were discussing Bible critics this week, and Bible critics noticed that there's a different style in Deuteronomy. That's correct. The reason there's a different style in Deuteronomy is because it was Moses himself initiating as a prophet the words. And then God told him to take those words and make that into one of the five books. As a matter of fact, everything that pertained to Moses was supposed to be part of those five books up to the last. Every event of Moses' life was part of the five books, up to his very death. There's a question as to whether the last eight sentences in the Torah were written by Moses or whether they were written by Joshua. That's a separate thing. Maybe we'll go into it at another time. But every event was supposed to be part of the Bible, and that's why the Bible stops right after Moses' death. It doesn't stop, as the Bible critics thought it should, when the Jews entered the land of Canaan, the land of Israel. That's where it would stop. That's where a novel would stop, you know, when they enter the Promised Land. But the five books of Moses are given a special level of prophecy, and that's why they end with the last event of Moses' life, his passing away. Now, getting back to this point. Now, Moses, in his exhortations in Deuteronomy, constantly tells the people, repeats it again and again. The main thing is to keep God's laws, and to follow God's ways. And the chukim and mishpatim in Hebrew means the laws and the ordinances and the justice, God's justice, etc., etc., and all the laws of the Torah. Repeats it again and again and again. The question, of course, is why should one follow God's laws or His ways? That is the question, and I think you have to have a clear answer in your mind about to this question. Otherwise, your whole religious shouldn't say faith. I mean, I hate the word faith. Your whole philosophy of Torah will be distorted. Okay, and now David says that someone wants to take this one up. Go ahead.
Rabbi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Rabbi, I think it has to do with the blessing and the cursing, doesn't it? The long life in the land. Are you talking about just for the Jewish people?
No,
or?
I'm talking about everyone. Ben Noach, every human being that wants to live according to the way God told them. Why do I do it? Why do I live according to the way God tells me? We'll take the law of stealing. That applies to Ben Noach and Ben Israel as well. I have an opportunity to steal something. And stealing could be a very simple thing. I mean, I just I went to a stand. I took a paper and I started to walk away, and nobody noticed, and I was a block away, and I didn't pay. I forgot to pay or whatever. Do I go back now, walk a block back to pay 50 cents for the paper, or do I keep on going? That's a major, major violation of Torah. Even though it's 50 cents, the amount of money does not make any difference, but it's stealing. It's taking something that's not yours. Now, why do I walk that block, or even a mile perhaps? Why do I go back to pay for that paper? What makes me do that? The answer is because God told me that's what I'm supposed to do. Now, my question is, what if God told me to do it? Still, the question is, why am I doing it?
To be obedient to God, to His commandments and precepts.
Okay. We'll take that.
To serve God, in my understanding, is you have the blessing and the cursing there.
Okay.
In the Torah, it's recorded. He said, "I put before you this day a blessing and a cursing.
Okay.
Choose life.
Right.
Choose correctly and live."
Okay.
He talked about the prolonged life afterwards.
Okay.
So there's more to it than just going back and paying the 50 cents, so to speak,
right.
Regardless of how many blocks or how many miles.
Right.
But you have your whole life, no matter how long or how short, it can be a benefit or it can be a fault while you're here. You're influencing other people. I mean, it don't just affect you, and that's one thing that really staggered me when I realized that years ago. That if you're serving God, yeah, I do fear God, and I do want to serve Him. I do want to be right with Him. But my life don't just affect me; it affects other people.
Okay.
So it's more than one fold.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you point blank. My question is this. What you said, I understand, and it makes sense, but I'm going to zero in a little more, focus in a little more on this point. My question is this. Do you serve God because of God or because of yourself? That's my question.
Well, I have to say because of me, because God really don't need me.
Okay.
He could fulfill His purpose through some other way.
Okay. Okay. In other words, when you are serving God, you realize that you are not benefiting God in any way whatsoever.
I honor Him
right.
By doing what He says.
Right. But you're not benefiting Him in any way whatsoever.
The way I look at it, I don't.
That's right. And you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, that's an important thing because people, especially in the idolatrous religions, the people do things in order benefit the gods, the god or gods, whatever the case may be. You know, it's they propitiate the gods, and what they do is they sacrifice or they give something to the gods. The concept is to benefit the god. That is an idolatrous idea, and that's why, by the way, the idea of a human god is a very powerful emotion because the people feel that since he's a human, he has like human emotions, and therefore when they do something, they're really making him feel good, you see. And that is the same kind of notion that you rejected, which is that you can benefit God in any way. As a matter of fact, there is an open verse that states this, and that is in the book of Job, it's 35:7. Okay? 35:6, I'm sorry, 6 and 7. And it states as follows, if thou hast sinned, what doest thou against him? And if thy transgressions be multiplied, what doest thou unto him? That's Elihu, by the way. Elihu is the correct answer. And if thy trans, I'm sorry, 7, if thou be righteous, what givest thou him? Or what receiveth he of thy hand? Okay? So, therefore, this statement is correct. And the Torah states clearly that when you and this, when by the way, there's a tradition that the one that wrote Job was Moses. So when you benefit the yourself in a mitzvah, you are strictly doing it for yourself. You are not benefiting God in any way whatsoever. That's extremely important. The benefit is strictly to you. Now, it is mentioned, by the way, in last week's reading as well, and that is in the reading last week was in Deuteronomy. Just give me one second. Here it is. Okay. It's in Deuteronomy 10:13. Okay? And it states as follows. Moses says, to keep the commandments of God and his statutes, which I command you this day, in order that it should be good for you. That's the statement. Okay? So, the good is for man. And again, the quote that you mentioned also, that God tells you should choose life, which obviously means that the benefit is for man and not for God. So then we have one question. Somebody will ask, they will say, well, if that's the case, then your religion is totally selfish, because all you're interested in is doing is benefiting yourself. Well, this is a very selfish kind of religion. What would your response be to that question? Okay.
I'll repeat that, Rabbi.
Okay. Now that we've established, as you've correctly stated, that man does not benefit God in any way when he keeps the laws, he's doing it for himself. So then the question that somebody would raise is, well, in that case, your religion is selfish because all you're concerned about is yourself. What would you say to that?
Well, that'd be a little tougher to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I reflected that it's not just solely me that, regardless of what anybody thinks, each person's life influences a lot of different people.
That's correct, but that's a secondary phenomenon. Even if you were alone in the desert, you still would keep the laws. You still would keep what God tells you to, even if you didn't affect another person at all. That's correct. You're right that there are repercussions for man's actions, and he does affect others. But primarily, you do it for yourself. I mean, that's primarily what motivates you, is you doing the laws for yourself. Okay? Now, the question is, somebody says, well, that's a very selfish attitude, and your religion is completely selfish.
It's just as hard as the first time you said. though, I really don't have a good answer for that. Okay. But I do believe this, that by keeping the commandments,
right,
even for selfish reasons,
yes,
I would still be honoring God.
That's correct. According to the Torah, there's no doubt about it. Well,
that's the best I can do, buddy.
What?
I said, that's the best I can do.
Not bad, not bad. You have good intuition, I think. Very good.
Let's see if we get anyone else.
Okay, let's get somebody else there.
Anybody else want to jump on that one?
The question is, how can you keep the Torah for yourself? Isn't that a selfish kind of an action?
All right. Jeff King has got the divine insight on this one.
Okay.
I would just say that man is selfish in a lot of ways, and this is just one of them when he wants to better himself. In the eyes of God, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay. That's good. The answer is, I agree with what you're saying. The answer is that the notion that people, the notion that people have that selfishness is an evil is incorrect. It is wrong. To do for the self is when man does for himself, what he is doing really is fulfilling a potential that God gave him. And no human being can be motivated by any other force outside the self. Every human being is motivated by the self, no matter what they do. And in the long run, the bottom line always has to be the self. There's no way psychologically possible for a person to do anything for anybody else without the self, because even if you do something for somebody else, it's because you think it's the right thing and you want to feel you're doing the right thing, which again is always the self. It is impossible to escape the self. The Torah never wants man to do that. God does not consider man doing something for himself as bad. On the contrary, when man does something for himself in the proper way, what he's doing is fulfilling the image and the potential, the divine image and the potential that God gave man, that God placed in man, which is really the difference between man and animal. See, an animal's potential is fulfilled automatically. Man's potential is fulfilled by his free will. When he acts in accordance with the ways of the Torah, then he fulfills himself as a human being, and he emerges as a full human creature. So man really partakes of his own creation, in a sense. He actually determines whether he's going to live as a human being or whether he's going to live as an animal, the animal part of him, which is not what he was meant to be. He's not fulfilling his potential. Now, therefore, when man acts selfishly in the proper way, then he is acting properly. The only thing the Torah is against is being selfish in the foolish way, which means really distorting man's image. If a person is greedy, so what he's doing is he's being selfish, but that selfishness is because the animalistic part of his nature is overpowering the main part of his nature, the essential part of his nature, the higher part of his nature, and therefore what he's doing is distorting the human image. When he distorts the human image, that's what is evil. When he makes the human image fulfilled properly, that is good. And to do for the self in the proper way is precisely what God wants us to do. That's why the Torah says, what's the reason Moses says, what's the reason that people should keep the ordinances of God? It should be good for you. What's the reason that God says, I give you life, I place before you life and death, and you shall choose life in order that you and your children shall live? In other words, what God is saying is that man has the ability to do for himself in the true sense, and when he does, he's fulfilling the human image. By doing that, he perfects himself, and not only that, but as you mentioned before, when he is perfected, he perfects all others around him. But the motivation for the self is precisely what the Torah wants. The Torah wants you to be properly selfish, intelligently selfish, to do for yourself what is truly the good. When you do that, then you emerge as a full human being, and then you are a benefit to yourself and a benefit to others as well. So being properly selfish is not an evil, but it's a good. That's the answer to that dilemma. It's false. The world assumes falsely that selfishness is an evil. It's a very shallow idea, and it's an untrue one also, because as I said before, it's impossible for a person to be motivated by anything other than the self. But I want to take you one step further, and I want to show you that really, when man reaches the highest level, he is not even involved in the self at all. And that is because, as you know very well, the greatest mitzvah in the Torah, again, for Ben Israel and Ben Noach as well, is the knowledge, the study, the understanding, the pondering of Torah. That really is what man is created for. Man is created to be involved in the search for God, which is a search through the Torah, and through the prophets, through the Torah, through the laws, through the halacha, through the oral law, through the whole system of Torah. When a person is involved in that, in pursuing that knowledge, that's how he perfects himself. And ultimately, the highest level of knowledge is knowledge of God, and like Moses had, and that means that man is constantly involved in perceiving God's infinite wisdom. Okay, it's an infinite process. Now, what I want to show you here is that when man is involved in that infinite process, he's involved in something, perceiving something outside of the self. Okay, so change the tape, right?
Yeah, you got it. Time to change the tape.
So when man finally does what is good for himself, which is being involved in the world of knowledge, What happens is he becomes interested in something outside of himself, which is God's Torah, God's knowledge, and perceiving God's infinite wisdom. So what happens eventually is that eventually the man is not thinking of himself anymore at all. He is in awe, and he is in a state of love and awe of God. That's the perfected state. That's the state that Moses was in constantly, always perceiving more and more of God's infinite wisdom and infinite knowledge. Now, this state is a state where man is turned, the soul of man, the mind's eye, is turned outside of the self towards God and towards God's wisdom and God's knowledge. Therefore, ultimately, the perfected state of man is not where he is thinking about himself or where he's even concerned about himself. As a matter of fact, because he is constantly viewing the infinite wisdom of God, he himself, as a personal creature, seems unimportant, completely unimportant. So that's why it says the man Moses was the most humble person on the face of the earth, the Torah says. As a matter of fact, one of the Bible critics says, how could Moses have written the Torah and say that he's humble? That would be the most haughty thing to say. Well, first of all, it's not Moses that wrote those words. He wrote the words, but it wasn't him that authored the words, I should say. He didn't initiate the words. The words were initiated by God. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that when the Torah speaks about humility, it's not talking about social humility. It's talking about a state of perfection where man, because of the fact that he is constantly awed by God, he himself becomes very, extremely unimportant. And he's not really concerned about what people say about him or whether he's superior or inferior to anybody else. It's an absolute state. It's not a relative state, not a social state. So that's why you have some of the, it is a famous Talmudic piece of Talmud where the Talmud says that after a certain scholar died, there was no more humility. So another scholar said, how could that be? I'm still here. So people think that that's arrogance. No, it's not arrogance, because he was speaking about the perfection of being in a certain state. And he wasn't speaking about social humility. Social humility is really shallow, and social humility is a false humility. People, that's not real humility anyways. People just say, well, I'm nothing. You know, they put themselves down, perhaps, or don't act haughty because they want the approval of people. That's a ploy. It's really it's really false humility. True humility is a certain state of knowledge. And the person that reaches that state knows that he has achieved that state. And he may choose even to tell another individual, if there's a reason to, that he has achieved that state. It wouldn't be haughtiness at all. It's an objective statement. It doesn't mean he can tell whether other people respect him or not, because he himself is in the state of appreciation of God's infinite wisdom, and he himself as a being, he considers himself actually worthless, like Abraham. He says, what am I, a speck of dust in the cosmos? Nothing. So this is true humility. And the point I want to get back to is that in that state, the person is constantly involved in a state of awe and love of God. So the self, the energies are removed from the self. The self is least important, is meaningless. So ultimately, man comes into a state where he is not selfish at all. He's not even concerned with the self. So it is a bit of a trip. When you first start off, you have to start off for a selfish reason. There has to be that motivation. And you keep the Torah because you know that this is the best thing for you. But then, the best thing for you is to be involved in knowledge. Not to be involved in you, but to be involved in something outside of you, which is knowledge of Torah. And that's when man is happiest, and that's when man achieves his true perfection, and his true self is realized. His potential is fully realized at that point. So ultimately, man goes away from the self. It's a bit of a circle, but I think if you think into it, you'll be able to appreciate the concept. You start off with a desire to improve the self, But then the Torah tells you, how do you improve yourself? By study, by knowledge, by following your intellectual curiosity, by searching for God, by searching for God's Torah and God's knowledge. That search is a search away from the self. And the more knowledge you gain of God, the more you realize how insignificant you are as a creature in the face of the of God, of the infinite. So eventually, and a man comes around to a state where he is not concerned with the self at all, and that is the selfless state. Okay. So, to sum it up, while there is nothing wrong, God wants us to do things for ourselves, and we have to start with that. Eventually, the perfected state is one in which you're looking outside of the self, completely outside of the self, a person of knowledge, a person of Torah. That is the perfected state, is again, for Ben Israel as well as for Ben Noach. And that's why we are involved here in the study of Torah for that reason. And that's why I feel we really have to start getting involved pretty soon with the study of Talmud, because that really is the science of Torah. See, Torah is the only religion that has a science that goes along with it. And if you don't have that science, you really cannot appreciate even the philosophy of Torah. You're not going to be able to appreciate it fully, because it's tied together. It would be like a physicist trying to know physics without mathematics. I mean, you can't do it. You could have a certain concepts, but you really can't. You have to know the science, and the science is tough. I mean, you have to get involved in mathematics and in the science of physics. You can't just read a Reader's Digest article and really know the science. As long as you don't get involved in the science itself, your view of Torah has to be, really severely limited. As I said, even in the perception of the philosophy. So this is something we really have to get around to. I'm sort of giving myself a little exhortation there. Now, let's get back to the question that we were discussing before. The question was, what is the purpose of the clean and the unclean animals? Why did God differentiate between the clean animals and the unclean animals? Now, we have an interesting, very interesting medrash, and this is not, the different levels of medrash. A lot of medrash is the official oral law. Some medrash is certain things that individuals said on their own, that there's a different kind of a level. Now, this particular medrash is really not just an opinion. This is one of the foundations of the concepts of the oral law. Now, this medrash says as follows. It says, just give me a moment here. He says, in the area, in the very chapter that deals with the kosher and the non-kosher animals, that's found two places in the Torah, once in Leviticus, and once again, Moses recapitulates in Deuteronomy. Now, the Medrash says as follows. What does God care whether a person slaughters an animal and eats it, or whether he stabs it and eats it? Do you benefit him, or do you harm him, whether you act either way? Or what does God care whether a person eats a clean animal or an unclean animal? And then the Medrash says, if you became wise, you became wise for yourself. And that's a quote from Psalms, the 50, just a second. It's a quote from Proverbs 9:12. Okay. Now, that's the end of the Medrash. A little bit more. It says, the commandments were only given to perfect the creatures. Okay? Then he quotes Psalms 12:7, where it says that God's words are pure. Okay? Just a second. And also, we also quote Proverbs 35. I'm giving you, see if you want to look it up later. Which that the words of God are a shield. Okay. Now, what does the Medrash say? The Medrash makes an important statement here. The Medrash makes it clear that the reason why God gave the laws about the clean and the unclean animals and about the slaughtering, ritual slaughtering, what the world refers to as ritual slaughtering, is not because of himself, but it's for the purpose of man. Now, this is extremely important. What this means is that when the Torah says that a specific animal is clean or not clean, it doesn't really mean that there is some difference. Again, getting back to the ark concept, like people think that there's something in the wood. There is nothing in the animal, actually. There is nothing. God does not love a cow, which is a kosher animal, more than a horse, which is an unclean animal. God does not despise a beetle any more than he does a dove. I mean, the universe is filled with God's wisdom and with God's glory, which means his wisdom, and everything that exists because of God's will. And God does not look with disdain at any of his creatures. So to say that there really is some superiority in an animal that is kosher over an animal that is non-kosher is, again, going back to that kind of a concept, like there's some kind of a difference in the in one substance over another. Now, what is the reason, if that's the case, if really the horse is equal to the cow or the bull or the sheep or the goat, kosher animals, so then, of course, the question is, so why were the people of Israel commanded to refrain from eating those non-kosher types? And it was stated quite clearly and lengthily in Leviticus and again in Deuteronomy, the animals which are permissible and the animals which are not, which are prohibited. And it's interesting, and why did Moses have to repeat that also? That's another good question. Why did he have to repeat it? Why was that part of his exhortation? The reason is because of the concept of the Torah itself. Many people say, why do you have to keep kosher? So I'm sure you've heard people say, well, the kosher animals are more healthy. If you eat pork, then you can get trichinosis. But the pork isn't the only thing that was prohibited. A horse will not give you trichinosis like pork, and a horse is prohibited as well, and so is the camel and other animals. So it has nothing to do, it can't have anything to do with health. That's a nonsensical reason. It's a reason that people, somebody thought it up because he thought of the pig, and he didn't really even know what the Bible states, the various animals the Bible states, and he came up with this idea, and somewhere or other that idea took off, like David mentioned before, the myths, you know, that become factual in people's minds. But if you look at the Bible itself, obviously that answer does not hold any water. Now, but if you look at the Bible does give you a reason for God commanding the B'nai Israel to keep kosher, to only eat certain foods. All right, kosher, by the way, is not the proper term. Kosher just means something which is correct. But at any rate, it became the use of the word kosher means the clean animals. But it means clean, and also means they're done when it's slaughtered properly. Now, if you take a look at Deuteronomy 14:21, okay, it says you shouldn't eat any a nevela. That would be a dead animal. Okay, I don't know what your translation is. I'm reading from the Hebrew. Is it carrion? Could be. Anyways, it says to the stranger that is in your land, you shall give it, and he shall eat it, or you can sell it to the stranger, because you are a holy nation to God your God. And then it says you should not cook a goat in the milk of its mother. Okay? Now again, does this make any sense to say that one animal is superior and God is saying that you shouldn't eat it, but you should sell it to the Gentile? or give it to the one that's a stranger in your land. Is that proper that God would want to harm one of his, another creature, another human being? This obviously makes no sense whatsoever. So the reason is not because the animal that's unclean has anything wrong with it in any way. It is the system of keeping kosher is tied to holiness, because that's what the verse says. See, the verse actually gives you the reason at the end of the entire chapter. It gives you the reason. It says it has to do with being holy. And if you take a look at Leviticus, again, it speaks about at the end of the chapter, it mentions about also the concept that you should be holy to your God. That is Leviticus 11:45. Because I am the God that took you out of the land of Egypt in order to be a God for you, and you should be holy because I am holy. Okay. Now, what exactly is holiness? So, in the Christian world, holiness is some kind of a mystical substance. But in the Torah world, holiness has a very definite property. Holiness means set aside, removed from the instinctual. That's what it means. That's why it says, because I, God, am holy. Because God has nothing, partakes of nothing of any kind of instinctual or anything physical in any way. So what God is saying to the people is that you should emulate me insofar as your nature allows you to be removed from the instinctual. Here is the clue as to what exactly the idea of kosher is, keeping kosher, eating the clean animal, not the unclean animal. And the reason is pretty clear. The reason is that God gave the Bnei Israel at that time the opportunity to perfect themselves. And what is this? How does this opportunity express itself? It expresses itself in a very simple formula, that your appetitive drive, the drive for food, is a very powerful one, extremely powerful. What we see in today's world, people are just concerned about trying to control it for their own appearances, and they still can't do it. Which the desire itself is not really is nothing more than an egoistic desire, and still have a hard time getting the instinct under control. But the Torah is saying that man, before he engages in the instinctual and appetitive drive, must first think. He must be able to use his mind. Must come into play here at this point. Take a look, for instance, at Leviticus 11:47, to differentiate between the unclean and the clean, and between the animal that can be eaten and the animal that is not to be eaten. What does this verse mean? When we say differentiate, differentiation in man is in the Torah and in the oral law, the scholars of the oral law. Differentiation means knowledge. Because the first step in knowledge is to differentiate. Man would not have any science if he couldn't differentiate. Science begins with classification. What is classification? Classification is differentiation. There's this type, and then there's another type. And then you differentiate into the various categories. Differentiation is the first step in knowledge. Now, what the Torah is telling us here is that in order for man to live, in order for Bnei Israel to be holy, what they must do is they must gain total control over the appetitive drive. They can satisfy the drive, that's fine. The Torah never tells man not to satisfy a drive that God instilled in man. The drive is there for a purpose, and it's God wants us to use it. But, and this is important, before man does, he must use his mind. In other words, there must be a supremacy of the mind over the emotional, over the appetitive. So when man desires food, he's very hungry, and he smells some good food, he must think to himself, just a moment, is this the kosher food or the non-kosher? Was this slaughtered properly? Now, and then if there's a question, he may have to even take out the oral law, which I can tell you could take him sometimes hours to determine whether something is really kosher or not, because, as I said before, Torah has a science attached to it, and that is the oral law. And sometimes you have to involve yourself in that science to find out whether something is kosher. It's not always as simple as people think. so many times the person will not be able to eat supper, but he'll have to take out the orla and delve into the problem until he comes to a conclusion, or if he can't, he's going to have to consult someone who can. So there we see that is considered holiness. Holiness means where there's a supremacy of the intellect, of the mind, over the emotional and the appetitive. The man can eat, but he doesn't eat like an animal. An animal, the moment it has the desire, nothing stands in the way. It immediately goes for the food. Man must be able to stop, to think, to differentiate. This I will eat, this I will not eat. This is okay, this I have to refrain from, no matter how painful it is. There's a supremacy of the soul over the instinctual part of man. That is what holiness means in the eyes of the Torah. So, then man is living with that part of him that reflects God, the divine image. And he's partaking of holiness because he's approaching the removal of the self from the instinctual. God, of course, is the one that is completely removed from any kind of physical or instinctual. God is the source of all wisdom and all knowledge and all existence. So man tries to emulate God in that way, and then he's living as a human being. That is the reason for kosher. The reason for kosher, you don't have to search for too far. If you just take a look at the Bible itself, almost spells it out, but as I said, you have to read a little bit between the lines. Now, just one moment. Okay. Something else which I'd like to bring to your attention as well. That is that idea, by the way, that idea that there must be a supremacy of the mind over the emotions applies not only to the area of the appetitive, before I get off this point, but it also applies to the area of the sexual. That's why Rashi says, when Rashi comments with when the Torah says that you should be holy, so Rashi says it means separate from the prohibited sexual relationships. And the reason is, again, because that is where the concept of holiness expresses itself. And not in abstention from any sexual, total abstention from sexuality. That is incorrect. To say that God created the sexual instinct and he doesn't want man to use it is pure nonsense in the eyes of the Torah. The commandment that was given to man was to be fruitful and to multiply. But he can partake of sex and he can enjoy sex. However, there's one requirement. Before he does, he must be able to differentiate. That he can have sex with this individual, but not with that individual. And as you probably know, there is also in the Torah the law which we call in Hebrew nida, which means that that during the period of menstruation, of course, it's a little more complicated than that. It's not just menstruation. It's actually menstruation plus. But it's certainly during the period of menstruation that the husband and wife cannot cohabitate. And that's a prohibition, which means not only that that the individual has to refrain from having sex with certain individuals on a permanent basis, even where it's permissible, he must be able to exercise control and say during this time he will not live with his wife, and vice versa, the wife of course will not live with the husband, and during another time they can. So there are two types of self-control that are expressed in this halacha with regard to control over the sexual drive. But basically, the two drives, and that's why Maimonides, in his 14 books, one book he calls the Book of Holiness. In that book, he has laws pertaining to the permissible and non-permissible foods, as well as permissible and non-permissible intercourses. And the reason is because the two most powerful drives of man are really the sexual drive and then you have the appetitive drive. And both of those drives must never control, they must never take over the human personality. They must never be the prime mover of the soul, so to speak. The prime mover of the soul has always got to be the soul itself, the mind, and the wisdom. And then, then properly directed, the instinct can be satisfied. And then man should satisfy his instincts because he should be happy, he should have a happy existence, and then he's existing and satisfying his instincts as a man, as a human being, not as an animal. And that is the state of holiness. Now, it's interesting that with regard to kosher as well, you have that same thing. Just like with regard to the sexual, there is sometimes the prohibition where one is never permitted to have sex with a certain person, and for instance, somebody else's wife, an incestuous relative. And then again, even in the case where it is permissible, but under certain conditions, he cannot have intercourse, which is another form of control. By the way, the reason for those two forms is because each one has its own difficulties. Some people have a difficulty saying, well, I could never have this enjoyment. That bothers them very much. So they have this fantasy, like, I could never, I know, as a matter of fact, some people in the yeshiva, they say, every now and then the question comes up, well, let's say you find out that you were not a Jew. What would you do? And inevitably, someone says, well, the first thing I do is go out and have a McDonald's hamburger. So before I became a Jew again, because the idea that you could never have that creates a tremendous fantasy in the mind of man. I can't ever have that. It must be great. It must be unbelievable. As a matter of fact, by the way, you know, you may be familiar with the statements of the rabbis about the tree of knowledge. And they ask, what kind of a tree was this? And there's an argument. Some bring a proof from this, from the verses, that it was a fig tree. Some say it was even wheat. Nobody says it was an apple, by the way. And there are different possibilities. Some say it was an esrog. Different fruits. But why does the Talmud say that? Why don't they say it was some kind of exotic fruit? Some kind of unbelievable fruit. The way the Torah, the way the Bible describes it, the Bible says, and when the woman saw the fruit and how luscious it looked, and the appearance was so, it had such a magnetic appeal to it. So you'd think it's some kind of unbelievable fruit that we've never seen. And the Talmud tells us, the scholars of the oral law say, no, it was a fig, or maybe it was wheat, or whatever. Why do they say this? The answer is very simple. The answer is, what the woman saw in the fruit, it really was a regular fruit. There was nothing special about it. But before she could have it, when she thought she could never have it, as long as man thought, I could never have this, man starts projecting.
Right, we got 60 seconds.
60 seconds, okay. Man starts projecting onto that which he never can have all kinds of qualities of how great that is. I must be able to have it at least once. And that really was was what happened in the Garden of Eden. That it was just an ordinary fruit. But once God said to Adam and Eve, you cannot have it, they started to imagine that there was some they started to see unbelievable properties in that fruit. The properties, of course, were from their own fantasy and their own imagination, and because of the fact that the prohibition was a final one, that you can eat from every tree in the garden except this one you cannot eat from. The prohibition is what gave the fruit its attractive qualities. Okay, we'll have to stop here, and we'll continue with the same subject next week.